Funny how things are. You figure nobody can really hurt you anymore. You've been hit with it all. And then some stupid thing that shouldn't matter does. Like, it's not when he's rough that hurts me, you know? Not hurts me so it matters. What hurts me is the weird thing when sometimes he forgets my name and calls me by hers, and she's just a damn machine. 37. Into darkness, Tanuja carried light, the glass tumbler warm in her hand, luminous, candle-cast shapes without form pulsing on the hallway walls, ahead of her, absolute blackness beyond the reach of the humble lamp. This building drew into it the hush of the church to which it stood connected, the quiet of those empty pews and that shadowed altar. The only sounds were the faint squeak of her sneakers on the waxed vinyl floor and the occasional sputter as the candle flame found impurities in the wick. The restroom doors did not feature automatic closures. The one at the women's lavatory stood half open. She pushed it wider and did not close it after she crossed the threshold. In this smaller space, with reflective glossy white laminate walls and mirrors, more light seemed to swell from the candle, and the shadows largely retreated. There were two sinks in a cove on the left side of the room, two on the right, and four enclosed stalls against the back wall. She went to the cove on the right and set the candle on the counter between those two sinks. In addition to the back wall, the side walls of the cove were also lined with mirrors, each reflecting the reflection in the other. Flickering candles ordered to infinity. Tanuja went into the nearest stall. Just enough candlelight bounced off the low ceiling to provide guidance. She tended to business and flushed the toilet. She returned to one of the sinks and cranked on the water and pumped liquid soap from the bottle. The water was hot, and from her lathered hands rose the rich orange fragrance of the soap. When she turned off the water and pulled a couple paper towels from the dispenser, she looked at her face in the back mirror, half expecting the stresses of the night to have visibly aged her. Food and drink had done their job, however, so that she didn't even appear tired. The candle before her, and its legions of reflections, rendered her eyes less dark-adapted than they had been in the hallway. When movement in the back mirror suggested a presence behind her, she thought at first it must be illusory, nothing more than shadow and light dancing to the soundless rhythm of the throbbing candle flame. But her confusion lasted only a moment. Whether he had entered through the open door to the hall while the water rushing into the sink masked his arrival, or whether he had been in one of the other stalls, he was there, and he was real. A youngish man, blonde hair that looked almost white in the spectral light. He loomed less than an arm's length away, and though she wanted to believe that he was an innocent parishioner who, for whatever reason, had remained behind after the play, she knew that he was no one that benign. She started to turn, but felt the poles of a handheld taser pressed hard into the small of her back. Although the cold steel pins failed to pierce her t-shirt, the garment didn't provide enough insulation to protect her, and she received a shock that disrupted nerve path messaging throughout her body. The sound that escaped her was like the faint lament of some small night creature seized in the talons of an owl. She seemed not to collapse so much as shiver to the floor, as if unraveling from her bones, there to shudder uncontrollably and gasp for breath that her lungs would not expand to receive. The attacker pressed the taser to her abdomen and shocked her again, and pressed it to her neck for a third blast, which was when she passed out. 38. Turning her face to Jane and opening her eyes, Petra Quist said, "Annabelle. Sometimes in the sack, he calls me Annabelle, just like the house computer. Weird, huh?"
"Have you asked him why?"
"He doesn't know why. He says it doesn't matter, it's nothing. But it's something to me." Leaning forward, touching the girl's hand again, Jane said, "Sometimes they hurt us most when they don't know they're hurting us at all. In fact, that's why it hurts. Because they don't even know us well enough to understand." That's some true shit. How can he be in my arms, in me, and call me, you know, a machine name? Do you know, with the program he has, Jane explained, each homeowner can customize the service name of the house computer? The party girl's blue eyes were clear, her stare direct, but she was still peering at the world from the bottom of a martini glass, a frown of puzzlement. What's that mean, or matter? He could name it anything from Abby to Zoe, so he named it after some woman he knows. Whatever might happen here in the next few hours, Petra must realize that she had no future with Simon, and yet she reacted in a proprietary manner. What damn woman? Why didn't he tell me about the bitch? If I were you, I'd ask him. Hell, I'd make him tell me. But listen, sweetie, maybe this is important. Exactly when does he call you Annabelle? I told you, like only sometimes, in the sack. When he climaxes? No. Well, I'm not sure, but I don't think ever then. Her gaze turned to the zip tie that secured her left hand to the chair. When he slaps me. Clamps a hand around my throat. When he's rough. Her voice feathered away into silence, and it seemed as if her mind had taken wing through a dark woods of memory. In time, Petra said, yeah. When he calls me Annabelle, there's always this anger. It's a little scary, but it's not me he's angry with. I always thought he was angry with himself for not, you know, being able. Mostly he's super ready, though sometimes not, but I'm hearing him now, how he sounds, and maybe it's not all anger, maybe mostly hatred. So bitter how he says her name, and then he's rough with me, and if he's rough enough, then he's ready and able. Able to get an erection, Jane clarified. Poor Simon, said Petra with seeming sympathy. How awful for him when he's got trouble with it. 39. In the wake of some nameless catastrophe that had extinguished the lights of the city and its surrounding settlements, fires leaped in man-made craters, and undulatory ashes rose on hot currents into a night watched over by a sinister, smiling moon. But mostly, there was darkness and smoke and a greasy odor not to be contemplated. Beer carriers bore the deceased upon their weary shoulders, and Brahmins officiated in the otherworldly light, as sweating cremators in loincloths stoked the flames. Here, in the Shumshan Ghat, where dead bodies were burned, uncountable mourners roamed less than half seen, to whom Tanuja must be as shadowy as they were to her, cries of grief issuing from their shadow mouths. She was in Mumbai again, not as a child, but as a woman, yet somehow it was the night her parents had perished in the plane crash, and though the plane had gone down far from India, she knew they were inexplicably here, among these victims of this unnamed cataclysm. Although they must be dead, Tanuja grew ever more desperate to find dear Bap and Mai, for it was urgent that, in death, they reach out to Sanjay, as she at the moment could not, reach out and warn him that he was in great peril. Waking from the dream, she needed a moment to realize she was lying on the restroom floor. She smelled hot candle wax and orange-scented soap. The man who had tasered her stepped into view and stood over her and reached down, offering assistance. She didn't want to touch him, but when she shied from his hand, he seized her by the wrist and yanked her into a sitting position.
"Get off your ass," he said, "or I'll drag you out of here by your hair."
She found her strength, rose, swayed, regained her equilibrium, and put one hand to her neck to learn the nature of something that constricted her. A collar. Her attacker pulled on a lead, and the collar tightened. While she had lain unconscious, he'd put her on a leash, as if she were a dog. After 7 years during which she and her brother had been ensnared by their aunt and uncle, the devious Chatterjees, freedom was no less essential than air to Tanuja Shukla. She prided herself on being a woman who coped with any situation, who was not easily alarmed. But a fright akin to panic now seized her. Heart knocking as though she'd run miles, she fumbled for the clasp on the collar but could not release it.
"Leave the candle," her captor said. "Don't think you can throw it in my face. We're going to the kitchen. You know the way."
As they approached the door to the hallway, she shouted a warning to Sanjay, and her keeper slapped her hard upside the head. She cried out again, "Sanjay, run! Run!" And the man whipped the end of the leash across her face.
"Don't be stupid," he said. "It's too late."
Stepping out of the restroom, Tanuja hoped desperately he'd not meant that her beloved brother had been captured, but instead that Sanjay had already escaped, that it was too late for them to get their filthy hands on him. With the lavatory behind them, darkness shrouded the first hallway, which seemed like a passage to Jahannan, where demons bred and all hope must be shed. She knew they entered the intersection of the two halls when to the left she saw a doorway defined by a faint aura of wick light. The kitchen. When she crossed that threshold, her keeper at her back, she saw this was indeed Jahannan, and she wept silently at the sight of Sanjay sitting at the table in defeat. His shirt was torn, his hair disarranged, as if he'd struggled against the hulking man who stood beside his chair. In the glow of the two remaining candles, Tanuja could see the collar around his neck, the leash drawn taut down the back of his chair and tied securely to the stretcher bar between the two back legs. 40.
"I'm sorry about this, but it's necessary," Jane said, as from her tote bag she withdrew a prepared ball of gauze and a roll of duct tape. "Although I don't think Simon could hear you from the foyer upstairs, I can't risk you calling out a warning. Once I've got him in the theater, I'll come back and strip off the tape, take out the gag, so you'll be more comfortable."
"You can trust me," Petra said. "I get it now. My situation."
"That sure was quick, huh? I was blind, but now I see."
"I'm not scamming you. I really get it. The only way out for me is your way."
"I believe you do get it, kid. But you've got Simon under your skin."
"No, that's over.
He hits you, chokes you, gets rough with you in I don't know what other ways. But when you're sitting here alone, without me to focus you on that one way out, you'll slip loose from your common sense and drift back toward him."
The girl was sufficiently self-aware not to argue. She said only,
"Maybe not.
Maybe isn't good enough." As though a hangover now pincered its way through her skull hours ahead of schedule, the girl's face paled under its light coat of foundation and powder blush. She had lip-printed the most recent martini glasses with much of her Maybelline, and the natural pink of her mouth now grayed a little, as if with the memory of her night on the town, of all that she had drunk and said and done.
"Later," Jane promised. "When I've opened his safe and put his money in front of you, I'll let you have a look at him and decide whether you want him or the cash and a new start. I can try to trust you then, because when I've finished with him, I think you'll rather have the money."
"What are you going to do to him?"
"That depends on Simon. Whether it's a cakewalk or a firewalk is up to him. Now let me put this gauze in your mouth. If you try to bite me, I'll slap you harder than Simon does, and I'll damn sure leave a mark, or three."
Petra opened her mouth, but then turned her head aside.
"Wait, I have to go potty. I need to pee."
"There's no time for that. You'll have to hold it."
How long?
Until you can't anymore.
That is so wrong.
It is. It's wrong, Jane agreed. But with Simon arriving soon, that's the way it has to be.
You're a total bitch.
You've said as much several times before, and I haven't once disagreed, have I? Now open your mouth. Petra took the gauze gag without trying to bite. Jane patched the girl's mouth shut with a rectangle of duct tape, and then wound a longer strip twice around her head to secure the first. 41. The creep who collared Tanuja was no prize, but he didn't scare her as much as did his partner. The bigger man stood maybe 6'5" and weighed about 230 pounds, but it wasn't just his formidable size that disturbed her. His cold stare impaled her with his contempt. He was graceful for such a giant, but his every move was oiled with arrogance, as if during all the years since he had been born into the world, he'd never seen one smallest reason to doubt he was superior to everything and everyone in it. He radiated a potential for sudden violence, no less than did a tiger with its ears pricked and nostrils flared and fangs bared as it watched a lame gazelle. The dishes, champagne glasses and ampules having been cleared from the table, they were replaced now with rubber tubing to be used as a tourniquet and foil-wrapped antiseptic wipes with which to sterilize the point of injection. Tanuja sat catty-corner to Sanjay, as she had when they'd been eating, now bound neck to stretcher bar as he was. Her dear Chhoti Bhai said he was sorry, as though by some mistake solely his, he'd brought these two down on them. The giant advised them to be quiet if they didn't want to have their tongues cut out, and although the threat was over the top, no feverish imagination was required to envision him fulfilling it with the deft use of a scalpel. The smaller man, blonde with blue eyes, had a prep school air, though he appeared to be in his 30s. Now he placed on the table an insulated cooler, identical to the one that Link Crossley's buddy with caterpillar eyebrows had brought to their house earlier in the night. After slipping his hands into a pair of cotton gloves, the preppy took from the cooler two hypodermic syringes, a few plastic-wrapped objects that Tanuja could not identify, and then a 9-inch square stainless steel box that was maybe 8 inches deep. When he opened the lid of the box, dry ice exhaled a frosty breath that winnowed away in the warm air and candlelight. Tanuja felt as if she were dreaming a nightmare that she had dreamed before. From the steel box, the preppy withdrew 6 insulated sleeves with Velcro closures. He shut the box and stripped off the gloves. Sanjay tried to pull away when the big man began to tie the tourniquet around his right arm, but resistance only earned him a blow to the face with the heel of the giant's hand, which snapped Sanjay's head back and stunned him, as might have any other man's point-blank punch with a tightly closed fist. Tanuja saw a thread of blood issue from one of her brother's nostrils. She tried to get up, but the leash secured her to the chair so that she couldn't stand. The preppy turned on the kitchen lights so that his partner might better see the target blood vessel in Sanjay's arm. With the efficiency of a trained phlebotomist, the big man used the hypodermic needle to insert a cannula into the vein, then set the needle aside. He punctured the seal on the first of the cold ampules and fitted it to the valve on the cannula. He held the ampule in an elevated position and opened the valve to whatever setting might be required. By intravenous infusion, the cloudy amber fluid began to move from the glass ampule into Sanjay's bloodstream, its nature unknown, its purpose unfathomed. Tanuja urgently wanted to know what, to understand why, but there was no point in asking, for these men would not tell her, and there was nothing to be gained by screaming, because no one would hear her in time, nor any way to resist that would long forestall whatever fate filled those ampules. She felt 10 years old again, in fresh receipt of the news of their parents' long fall from the sky, in the shadow of her smiling aunt, Ashima Chatterjee, for whom a sister's untimely death was less a grievous loss than a golden opportunity. As a child, she had found the world mysterious and forbidding, wound through with more darkness than light, had perceived threats coiled everywhere from the attic to the space under her bed, from an open woods at noon to the front yard at night. Sanjay, too, had early on been of a noirish sensibility, and yet it was because of him that Tanuja had over time been able to put her countless fears behind her, to reconceive the world as a place of wonder, brimming with magical possibilities, to have such conviction in that revised conception that her career as a writer flowered from it. By his kindness, by his caring, by his patient and wise instruction, her little brother, with 2 minutes less experience of this life, had been her therapist, her spiritual guide, teaching her the truth and power of free will to make of this world more than it seemed to be, more even than it was, and thereby purge the darkness of all threat and find in it as much magic as in the light. Only a year or so ago, she had realized that Sanjay's noirish point of view had remained, primarily the way he perceived this life, though he believed in free will and was never in a mood as dark as any in his writing. He didn't see a world with wonder-brimming and magical possibilities, as he had so passionately, persistently encouraged her to see it. In a family with too much stoicism, with too little love expressed, and following the plane's fall into the sea with no love at all, Sanjay openly adored his sister. He was troubled that so much frightened her and so little enchanted. One day, he resolved to banish her fears and see her grow in happiness. He had pretended that the vision of a wondrous world full of miracles and marvels was his to share, and he had championed it with such enthusiasm that his pretense had become her truth, her unshakable conviction. She and Sanjay had been conceived in the same moment, had come into the world together, and she could not imagine her life unspooling past the moment when her Choti Bai no longer breathed. As she watched the third ampule drain through the cannula into her brother's arm, Tanuja welcomed the infusion of the remaining three into herself. For regardless of what might now have been done to Sanjay, she must follow him into the unknown, and, if given the chance, be for him what he had always been for her. The hateful Rakshasa finished the first phase of his demonic task by removing the cannula from Sanjay's arm. He didn't bother to press a band-aid over the needle puncture, but allowed a button of blood to form in the crook of the elbow, and a scarlet thread to slowly unravel from it, like a misplaced stigmata. Tanuja didn't resist, nor did she allow them the satisfaction of seeing her fear, as the preppy applied the tourniquet to her right arm. He palpated the visible veins to find the most generous one and swabbed the skin with the sterilizing pad. The big man came around the table, carrying another cannula, the second hypodermic, and three large ampules. 42. At 23 minutes past midnight, headlights swept off the street and arced onto the circular driveway, followed by a gleaming black Cadillac limousine with heavily tinted windows. The long car motored to the portico with surprisingly little engine noise, as menacing as it was elegant. The quiet limo seemed even somewhat eerie at this hour and in these circumstances, as if skull-faced death had traded in his classic horse-drawn carriage for a modern conveyance and would step out with a silver scythe, wearing not a hooded cloak but a Tom Ford suit. Standing back from the foyer window, Jane Hawk watched as the chauffeur opened a starboard door and Simon Yegg appeared. He was attired not in a suit, but in red and white sneakers, tan chinos, a brightly striped rugby shirt, an unzipped leather jacket, and a pink baseball cap with a large number 3 on it. A A 46-year-old white guy who thought he could pull off the look of a cool black rapper half his age.
The limo glided away as Simon unlocked the deadbolt. The alarm sounded as he stepped into the house.
Jane stood on the hinge side of the door, concealed from him.
Annabelle, disarm security. 5651 star.
The alarm fell silent, and Annabelle informed him that it was disarmed, whereupon he said,
Annabelle, follow me with light.
As the chandelier brightened, Simon Yegg closed the door and saw Jane holding the 6-ounce plastic bottle at arm's length. She sprayed his nose and mouth with chloroform, and he dropped with a swish of clothing like a basketball through a net, although when he hit the floor, he had no bounce in him. She hadn't been able to use chloroform with the girl because she'd needed to interrogate her in a timely manner. She had hours to devote to Yegg if she needed them. Chloroform was highly volatile. To be sure that he remained unconscious, she put a double thickness of paper towels over his face, trapping the fumes. He wasn't having a breathing problem. At the security system keypad, Jane set the alarm in the home mode. She returned to the front door, engaged the Schlage deadbolt, and peered out the window. The limousine was long gone. In the pale penumbra of a street lamp, a slinking coyote turned its luminous yellow eyes toward the house, as if it sensed her watching. Muscular, 5'10", weighing about 180 pounds, Simon posed a greater logistics problem than had Petra Quist. There were always ways to accomplish such tricky tasks, however, and in this case, the problem himself had thoughtfully provided her with the solution. From the garage, she had earlier brought up the mechanic's sled. She rolled it to his side and locked the wheels. 180 pounds of inert Yegg was a lot of dead weight. Getting him onto the board required treating him as if he were several loosely connected sacks of potatoes, and after 4 or 5 minutes of struggle, she got the job done. The board was too short to hold all of him. His legs were off the sled from mid-thigh down, but the drag factor wouldn't slow her too much. To prevent his arms from sliding off the board, she undid the belt on his Gucci chinos, shoved his hands under the waistband, and cinched the belt tight. He lay there as if fondling himself. To fashion a pull for the sled, she had employed one of the extension cords that she'd found stored in a garage cabinet. After flipping up the built-in chocks on the wheels, she pulled Simon Yegg to the main elevator, leaving the baseball cap on the foyer floor. Descending to the basement, she lifted the paper towels and checked the color in his face and made sure he was still breathing well. Then she replaced the towels and lightly spritzed them with more chloroform. In the theater, the carpet somewhat resisted the squeaking wheels, and when Jane pulled the sled into the lobby, Petra sat up straight, eyes wide. The girl worked her jaws, perhaps trying to shift the wad of saliva-soaked gauze in her mouth. She made urgent noises that, through the duct tape, were not words. Jane propped open the door between the lobby and the theater. She maneuvered the sled into the main room. There were 3 rows of chairs. 5 per row, but they were neither traditional theater seats nor in harmony with the French theme. These adjustable loungers, upholstered in leather, appeared more conducive to sleep than to cinema. The rows of chairs were flanked by wide aisles. Because the floor sloped down to a stage and a big screen, currently out of sight behind a burgundy velvet curtain trimmed with enormous tassels, gravity more than overcame the impediment of the carpet. Between the front row and the stage, an 8-foot-wide flat area extended the width of the theater. She parked the sled there, where earlier she had left 3 more extension cords, the workbench stool from the garage, a Bernzomatic butane lighter with a long flexible neck that she had found in a kitchen drawer, and 6 dozen 16-ounce bottles of water. She passed the first of the extension cords under the sled and used it as a rope to secure Simon Yegg's upper arms to the board. In similar fashion, she strapped down his waist and then his legs. The rubber on the cords didn't allow knots to be drawn as tight as she preferred them. Therefore, with the butane lighter, she fused them into knots that couldn't be undone using some of the water in one of the bottles each time the melting rubber began to flame. She plucked the paper towels off the wife killer's face and tossed them aside. A faint, moist residue of chloroform lent a sheen to his upper lip, which evaporated even as she watched, and a few tiny drops of dew sparkled in his nose hairs. Simon would regain consciousness in 10 to 15 minutes. 43. After Tanuja Shukla receives her nanomachine control mechanism, Carter Jurgen gathers up the empty ampules and other debris, and he returns everything to the cooler, leaving no significant evidence behind. He goes to the women's restroom and returns with the candle glass that was left there. He sets it on the table with the other two and turns off the overhead fluorescence, preferring to pass the waiting period in this softer and more atmospheric light. Dubose stands by the kitchen sink, smoking a joint, taking deep breaths and holding them and expelling them less with a sigh than with a gruff, bearish exhalation, all the while watching the girl. Jurgen supposes he knows what that means. This waiting period isn't likely to be as tedious as it has been during other recent conversions. He settles at the table with his iPad and goes online to explore hotel possibilities for a Caribbean vacation that he's hoping to take in September. But for Dubose's smoking and what little noises Jurgen makes, the church kitchen is quiet. The twins now understand that any question will receive a blow rather than an answer, as will any comment or argument. They are powerless, and they are acutely aware of it. All the Shukla moxie has evaporated. They don't know what the injections have done to them, and fear of the unknown is paralyzing. If they aren't in despair, if they haven't utterly abandoned hope, they are despondent, with no current capacity for hope. Part of the reason they do not speak is no doubt because they fear that their voices will sound weak and lost, that hearing themselves will only further discourage them. Sooner than Jurgen expects, Dubose pinches out the remainder of the joint, drops it in a jacket pocket, and crosses the room to the girl. He unties the leash from the stretcher bar and tells her to get up. When she hesitates, he jerks hard on the leash, as if he's an impatient child and she's a pull toy that's wedged immobile. She rises from the chair, and her brother says anxiously, "What's happening? What are you doing?" Jurgen leans forward, grabs the kid's left ear, twists it hard enough to crush a little cartilage and make his point. Sanjay tries to pull his head away, but Jurgen won't allow that. As Dubose leads the girl toward the hallway door, she looks back and says her brother's name, not as if calling for his help, but as if saying goodbye. Then she and Dubose are gone. When Jurgen lets go of the ear, Sanjay tries to thrust to his feet, as if there might be some slightest chance that the leash will snap, or the collar come undone, or the dinette chair disintegrate as he thrashes valiantly in it. He transitions directly from despondency to that energized form of despair called desperation. Although he surges from stoic immobility into a screaming rage, his fury will not gain him anything, for he is furious less with Dubose than with himself, with his helplessness, which will endure for the rest of his life. Jurgen puts aside his iPad to watch Sanjay, who for the moment is more entertaining than any Caribbean vacation. In but a minute, Sanjay exhausts himself and sags in the chair, slick with sweat. He is like a horse that, having been thrown into a panic by a snake, has stamped and reared so often to no avail that it has no strength remaining for anything other than the tremors coursing through it from throttle to thigh, its blind terror otherwise expressed only in its eyes, which seem to swell in their sockets, encircled by an extraordinary field of white, the irises like twin craters in twin moons. Such are Sanjay's eyes when Carter Jurgen says, "In a way, she did this to herself, to you. The two of you were on the Hamlet list to be adjusted, but you weren't near the top until her novel was published 3 weeks ago, Electo Rising. The response of certain critics and too many deeply affected readers led the computer to move you to the top of the list. Jurgen is not sure that Sanjay can make sense of what he hears, so deeply is he sunk in misery, his mind turning round and round on a descending spiral path of grief and guilt. But Jurgen and Dubose have won the day, and there's no point in achieving a win if you can't have some fun with it. Her novel will inspire the worst ideas among impressionable younger generations. The computer identifies it as potentially a dangerous, iconic work. So it's fitting, don't you think, that the two of you will now be tasked with discrediting it and all your other writing, ensuring that every word the two of you have put on paper will go out of print forever. Sanjay's gaze fixed on the nearest of the candles, the faux fire bright in his eyes, which might never again be alive with a true fire.
It used to take 8 to 12 hours after injection for the control mechanism to fully form across the brain. Only in the last few days have we been using a new version of the secret sauce that completes the job in 4 hours. Millions of brain-tropic molecular machines swimming upstream toward those 3 pounds of tissue in your skull. Sanjay Shukla is only secondarily the body in this chair before me. The essential you is those 3 pounds. Can you feel those millions of invaders swimming through you and at the same time toward you? I am fascinated by it all. I wonder, when they pass through the walls of cerebral capillaries and into the very tissue of the brain, when they begin to link up and form a web across the various lobes, in the final hour of your independence, before everything settles down up there, will you feel as if spiders are creeping inside your skull?
Sanjay's eyes turn from the candle and meet Jurgen's stare. In a whisper, he declares, "You're insane."
"Sticks and stones," Jurgen replies.
"Evil," Sanjay says. "Not all madmen are evil, but all evil men are mad."
Jurgen smiles.
"You shouldn't speak so disparagingly of someone who will shortly be your absolute master."
44. Jane returned from the theater to the lobby and released the chocks on the wheels of the office chair. She rolled Petra Quist into the theater and parked her in the shadows behind the back row of seats, where she could see and hear what was to come. Then she fixed the wheels in place once more. After unwinding the duct tape, Jane waited while the party girl worked the sodden mass of gauze between her teeth and expelled it into her lap. Considering that Simon Yegg made a habit of hurting her and that she claimed to be over him, Petra seemed unduly worried about his well-being, almost breathless with concern.
"My God, what have you done to him? Did you kill him already? His face was covered. Wasn't his face covered?"
"It's not covered now," Jane said, directing Petra's attention to her nuclear love machine below, bound like Gulliver in Lilliput. She had adjusted the theater lighting so that only the stage and the area immediately in front of it were illuminated. "He's just asleep, recovering from an encounter with chloroform."
"What are you going to do to him?"
"Not a fraction of what he deserves."
"He's not all bad. I mean, he's not so nice sometimes, but he's not a hopeless shit."
Jane said, "Listen, I've brought you into this so you can hear him and maybe learn something. Lying down there, Simon's not at an angle where he can see you, even if he turns his head, even if you weren't in the dark up here. Among other things, you'll learn what he really thinks about you. It'll be worth hearing. But if you can't keep your mouth shut, I'll gag and duct tape you again."
"No, don't. I can't. I thought I was going to puke and choke on it, you know?"
"Then be silent."
"Okay, I will. But please, please, please let me go potty."
Those blue eyes were so pellucid that they seemed like windows to a soul in all its truth. But artful cunning was required to meet eye to eye for as long as this and seem guileless. Jane put a hand to her captive's head, and the girl flinched. She wanted only to smooth the disarranged hair back from Petra's forehead, which she did, before saying, "Sorry, but I don't trust you yet. In spite of all your attitude, you have so little self-esteem that you'll go on needing Simon until you have even less respect for him than you have for yourself." Sudden color pinked the girl's pale cheeks, and her chin thrust forward. She seemed about to pull the trigger on her temper. But she restrained herself, opting for a look of pitiable distress. "I really gotta pee." "It's not my chair," Jane said, "so have at it." 45. Sanjay Shukla finds no hope in the candlelight, and yet another reason for despair in Carter Jurgens' eyes, and so he turns his attention to the open door through which Radley DuBose led Tanuja. In a voice breaking with anguish, he says, "Where has he taken my sister?"
"If Pastor Gordon has an office here," says Jurgen, "it's a cozy space with all the amenities. He didn't strike me as one of those clergy who believes there's any point to a vow of poverty. Mainly, my partner will want a nice big sofa."
The thin sound that escapes the younger twin suggests an intensity of grief that Jurgen has never heard before.
"You don't have to worry that I might have any such intentions, Sanjay. That good old boy was raised in backwoods West Virginia." "I wasn't." "Oh, yes, he was accepted at Princeton and earned a degree. But the standards expected of Princeton grads, if any standards are expected at all, are magnitudes below those of Harvard alumni. I'd rather be partnered with one of my own kind, but I must admit he does keep things interesting."
The girl's first cry seems to issue from a greater distance than is in fact the case, and it sounds like the forlorn voice of some exotic night bird, though lonelier and eerier than a loon's call, and more miserable than the moaning of an ibis. Jurgen's buttoned-up old-school father, Carlton, has long been a member of New England's preeminent bird-watching club, one of his many cultured interests. Inevitably, some of the elder Jurgen's deep knowledge of all things avian has rubbed off on his son, although by his university days, Carter's interests were quite different from those of his old man. Tanuja's protests no longer sound bird-like in any way, nor distant. They are shrill and terrible. She is apparently resisting with all her strength, though considering DuBose's size and the ferocity of his appetites, resistance is futile. Kicking violently at the floor, Sanjay rocks the chair backward from the table and attempts to stand. But the taut collar-and-leash tether makes it impossible for him to unbend his body from a sitting position and thrust to his feet. He can neither release the collar nor reach far enough behind and down to the knot at the stretcher bar. The chair topples onto its side, bearing him with it. He yanks on the arms of it as though he will break them off with his bare hands, but the frame of the chair is welded steel. The minimal restraint allows the illusion of easy escape. Therefore, the truth of his helplessness is all the more frustrating. He is furious in his anguish, in his excruciating grief, managing to rattle the chair in a half-circle to no useful purpose. Throughout this, he never shouts or screams, but grunts and hisses and snarls in this dumb animal striving, breathing ever more noisily, until at last he is no longer able to deny his impotence. He lies on his side, in the cage of his chair, immobilized and weeping miserably. If the sister continues to make any noise, her protests are of little volume and contained within some room farther along the hall, where what was inevitable has come to pass. Carter Jurgen rises from his chair and stands over Sanjay, gazing down at him.
"It's not as bad as you think. It won't haunt you the rest of your life. You won't forever be eaten by guilt. In fact,
Though your sister is traumatized and filled with shame now, she'll have entirely recovered by dawn. No trauma, no shame. Once your control mechanisms self-assemble and you've become adjusted people, I only need to tell you and her to forget everything that occurred tonight, and all of it will be gone from memory, including me, including my partner and what he's done. A thing that can't be remembered, well, that's as good as if it never happened. 46. Cinema Parisian. The area in front of the stage and the apron of the stage itself lighted as if for live entertainment to precede the movie. The front row of seats in half light, the second row in shadow, the third in darkness draped. And at the highest point of the theater, shrouded in gloom, the lone member of the audience, Petra Quist, perhaps a candidate for redemption, perhaps beyond reclamation. Jane placed the workshop stool beside the mechanic's sled and sat there, as Simon Yegg muttered, his facial expression morphing to reflect the rapidly changing circumstances in one of the vivid and macabre dreams that sometimes made an ordeal of chloroform sleep. He startled awake, blinked at her towering over him, mumbled, "No," and closed his eyes as though he could refuse this reality and receive another. He repeated this exercise.
"No. No. No. Hell no."
Each time becoming more aware of his hard circumstances, testing the extension cords that bound him until he came to the realization that there was but one world for him, whereupon he said in rapid order,
"This sucks. Who are you? What's this about? You're the walking dead. You realize that? You're as dead gets."
Jane said, "Given your situation, you talk some amazing trash. But I guess maybe you've got a good reason to pretend you're full-on macho." He clearly didn't like what she said, but he failed to comment on her implication.
"You can't scare me. I don't scare. You got me. Good. That was smart, the way you got me like this. Real smart. So let's deal. You want money? Everyone wants money. So okay, I got money. Though you should live long enough to spend a dime."
After a silence, smiling as if he amused her, Jane said, "Maybe I'm not here for money. Maybe this is about the Hamlet list."
"The what?"
"Maybe it's about these bastards who call themselves the Techno-Arcadians, like 13-year-old nerd boys meeting in a clubhouse in a tree."
"You sure you have the right address, honey? Maybe this would make sense to somebody next door, but it's just noise to me."
His confusion seemed genuine. His brother, Booth, big man in the Department of Justice, had been steering government business to him for years, but that didn't mean he trusted Simon enough to involve him in the conspiracy that had killed her Nick. She said, "Or maybe I'm here on behalf of your ex-wives." He didn't need to hesitate to formulate a deceitful comeback.
"They took me to the cleaners. What more could they want?"
"They took you? Not the way I hear it."
"Everybody has their story."
He realized that in addition to the cords binding him, his hands were in his pants and cinched tight under his belt.
"I got a circulation problem here. My fingers are numb."
"Word on the street says it's not your fingers that's numb."
"What does that even mean?" he dared to ask. "Are you a crackhead, bitch? You freebasing cocaine or something? You've maybe got a psychological problem, honey. Don't bring me that. I'm no psychiatrist. Let's get this done. Let's talk money."
Trammeled beyond any hope of escape, flat on his back, gazing up at her on the high stool, he had to be disoriented. On the ladder of fear, other men might have been on the step labeled dread or even terror. Simon didn't appear to have gotten as high as mild disquiet. Techniques for managing fear and subverting it into positive energy could be taught, but Simon's attitude and responses did not suggest he'd been through such instruction. Instead, his apparent confidence was in fact unalloyed arrogance, and his fearlessness more likely had its roots in solipsism, the belief that in all of the world he alone was truly real, the center of the universe, and its only story, while other people were just furnishings, mere provisions of which he could make any use he wished. In her serial killing and mass murder cases with the Bureau, she had encountered more than a few sociopaths like him. Because of his delusional view of reality, there were strings she might use to manipulate him. However, it was necessary always to recognize his twisted genius and his cunning, for such a man could be dangerous, no matter how thoroughly he had been tied down and immobilized. "Everybody has her story," Jane quoted him. "Except your first ex, Marlowe, who has no story these days because she was beaten to death in Paris."
"I loved that girl. She was my world, she truly was. She was sweet, but she had no common sense. What the hell was my Marlowe doing in a radical Muslim neighborhood anyway? Looking for a rich sheik?"
"And Alexis has no story anymore either. She was pushed off a cliff in Yosemite. 300 feet is a long way to fall, knowing you'll be dead on impact."
"Pushed? Whoever said pushed? She and some idiot boyfriend were hiking on an insanely dangerous trail. They were casual hikers. They didn't have the skill for it. Made me sick when I heard about it. Just sick to my stomach. Heartsick. I was in Hawaii at the time. Ruined Hawaii for me. Sure, our marriage didn't work out, and that was mostly my fault. I'm not proud of sometimes thinking with my little head instead of my big one. I'm no choir boy. But I loved that girl. And it hurts me. Hurts me bad. Her life was cut so short."
Jane had the urge to get off the stool and step on his throat, put all her weight into it, and hear his esophagus collapse with a satisfying crunch. Such was the response that his kind too often elicited, because his mission in life wasn't what he thought, wasn't to be the unconquered hero of an epic story of power and triumph. His role was to anger others and dispirit them, and, if possible, foster in them a desire to descend to his level and tempt them to act with a viciousness equal to his. She did not crush his throat, but the desire to do so remained. "I guess it also hurts you when you think what's happened to your ex, Dana. How she's totally agoraphobic now, so afraid of the wider world that she can't leave her house, lives such a prescribed existence. She's more isolated than a nun in a cloistered order." Somehow, by attitude alone, Simon almost succeeded in making it seem that he was in the higher position, looking down on her.
"Don't be such a snarky bitch. It's tiresome. If you know Dana, you know what a tragedy that is. Not just the whole agoraphobia thing, but Dana herself. I mean, she's smart as a whip and so compassionate. She loves people, all people. Not the tiniest bone of prejudice in that girl. But for all her virtues, and there's a lot more than I've mentioned, in spite of her many virtues, she's always been a little off. You hear what I'm saying? I fell hard in love with her. Who wouldn't? So I didn't see the problem for a while, but then it became undeniable. She was always a little off true north, like only 2 or 3 degrees off, but over time it gets worse, until she's not going anywhere on the compass that people like you and me would recognize. She's off into some weird territory. I feel so bad for her."
He paused in his odd mix of encomiums and self-justifications to cock his head and regard Jane from a slightly different angle, like an earthbound broken-winged bird turning one eye toward the sky to calculate the likelihood of single-wing flight. After a moment of silence, he said,
"You're not here about Dana or Alexis or Marlowe. My Sarah sent you, didn't she?"
"Sarah Holdsteck? Wife number 4? I know that part of your history, but I've never even spoken to her," Jane lied. Briefly, but only briefly puzzled, he said,
This isn't about any ex-wife. So is it Petra? No, it can't be. Don't tell me Petra's brought in some radical feminist muscle to break some money out of me. I wouldn't have figured Petra capable of that kind of thing.
Why wouldn't you think her capable of it? He shrugged, as best he could, in his restraints.
She's a fun kid, and she's smart enough, but she doesn't have it in her to look out for herself.
Yeah? Well, a little earlier tonight, she came at me with a broken vodka bottle, tried to slash my face.
No shit. She really did?
He appeared delighted by the image that those words had painted in his mind.
Of course, after a girl's night out, she would have been drunk. And she can always hold her own when it's just girl on girl. You gotta tell me, sugar. What did you do to piss her off?
I liked bitch better.
What?
Don't call me sugar.
Yeah, you're one of those types. I get it. But what did you do to piss off Petra?
I needed her to tell me some things about you, and she didn't feel in a mood to cooperate.
Where is she now?
Dead, Jane lied. She came at me hard, and I shot her.
You're shitting me.
Her body's in the kitchen.
Damn. That's some of the sorriest news I've heard in a while. She was really hot. The word hot doesn't do her justice. She was a fine, fine piece of girl.
He sighed and shook his head.
You're not here because of the wives, and not here because of Petra. You're here for you. So then why all this talk, 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 talk? Let's do business.
What did you mean Petra can hold her own when it's just girl on girl?
What's it matter now?
Humor me. I'm the curious type.
I've never been tied up for a gossip session before. Okay. All right. With a guy, any guy, she was like putty, just rolled over no matter what, did what she was told, drunk or sober or in between, did what she was told, took what she was told to take, and liked it. Never complained, no matter what.
Jane leaned forward on her stool and peered down as if to read him more closely. No matter what? So, did you hit her?
Hit her? Hell no. I can get all the girls I want without ever hitting them. What's wrong with you talking trash like that? We're making progress, correcting the record, slowly coming to terms, and now you diss me like this? Did you hit her? I don't take offense easy, but that one's over the line. Did you come here just to insult me, or you want something worth the risks you've taken?
Jane got off the stool. She walked away from him and then back toward him, rolling her shoulders, stretching her neck. Two things I want. First, tell me where the cash is, and don't play any games with this because I'm not Petra. I don't roll over.
Maybe I look stupid right now, but I'm not. I give you one wrong number, you'll come back here and start cutting me or using a pair of pliers on my balls. I got no leverage. All I want is we do our business and get you gone.
After he told her where to find the safe and divulged the combination, she said, You just want me gone. But what about Petra? Will you hang that murder on me?
There won't be a body by tomorrow morning, he said. It'll be ground up sludge poured in a pond at a sewage treatment plant. She's the kind no one will miss. Even those dumbass bitches she goes club hopping with. In a month, they won't remember her name. So she went off to Puerto Vallarta or Vegas or Mars with some other stud, just slutting her way to an early grave. So what? Who cares? Nobody. She's nothing.
She had parked Petra in the back of the theater because she wanted her to hear the truth of Simon from his lips, in the hope that the girl might ask herself what had gone wrong with her, that she'd involve herself with such a man. But in Petra's fragile condition, Simon's acid contempt might do her more harm than good, and it was regrettable that she'd had to hear it. Jane asked, You sure you can get the sewage treatment plant thing done?
Haven't you been telling me how I'm great at making women go away? And does it seem like I worry about cops? Let me tell you, honey, I'm so connected I could get a police escort to that sewage plant.